across Australia on RN, on the ABC's mobile app, or via the podcast. Great to have your company for Big Ideas. Hello, I'm Paul Barclay. What does it really mean to be happy? Can the relentless pursuit of it make us sad? Can we develop or teach ourselves to be happy? What does the research tell us about it? In this discussion, presented by the Ethics Centre in Sydney, you'll hear three quite different perspectives. Your speakers are a literature academic, Camelia Nelson, social psychologist, Brock Bastian, and to start us off, here's psychotherapist, Mark Alfred.
So I want to suggest something pretty straightforward, and that is that happiness is subjective. So for some of you, this will be harder than others, but I don't know if you can remember back to when you were a teenager and you were listening to some music, and perhaps you found it really enjoyable, it made you really happy, but perhaps some other people in your household, it didn't make them very happy. What about food? Maybe you're a steak lover. Maybe you love steak and eating a good steak makes you really happy. For the vegetarian, it doesn't make them happy at all. So perhaps happiness is subjective. So what I want to do is I want to share with you some research just from the last few years of what the suggestion of the research says is likely to make you happy. But what I want to recommend is that we make it an experiment. That over the next 7 days, that you experiment with these experiences. And the good news is that, unlike in school, the only person you have to hand the assignment to is yourself. At the end of 7 days, you just have to say to yourself, did it work or didn't it? So that's my suggestion, of a bit of a happy experiment. So my first suggestion is it's all subjective. So let's see what the research suggests makes most people happy. The first is, I want to ask you this question, and I want you to think about it, is what are you most grateful for? So I should start by saying I'm really grateful for this opportunity to speak to you today. And in being grateful, it's actually increasing my levels of subjective well-being. This kind of term, subjective well-being, is actually subjective in itself. It's the academic term that some people use when they're talking about happiness. So for me to have this sense of attitude of gratitude, it actually creates this higher levels of happiness within me, an attitude of gratitude. See, what I'm doing is I'm exchanging expectation for appreciation. So I wonder if there's somebody brave who could just share with us, very simply, and we've got a mic that's going to come to you, just one thing that you're happy for. I just need one person, the bravest person in the room, just to share with us, very simply, one thing that you're happy for. Just place your hand in the air. Here we go.
My name's Debbie.
Debbie?
And I'm happy I've got somewhere to live.
Okay, so one second, let's just stop there. So you're grateful that you've got somewhere to live. Now, the research tells us that if we constantly remind ourselves of what we're grateful for, then it's going to make us happy. But the research is a little bit more interesting, because what it suggests is if we think about and consider why we're grateful for it, our levels of happiness go up considerably. So can I ask you, why are you grateful for that?
Because I have a health condition that limits my ability to earn an income. So I'm really lucky that I own my own house.
Fantastic. Thank you so, so much. So can you see how stage one is, I want to suggest for your experiment this week, that each day, maybe in the evening, that you just write down three reasons why you're happy and just pick one of them and write down why it makes you happy. Okay, so that's experiment number one. Now, I want to make a suggestion and ask a question. Is happiness all in the mind? And to kind of consider this, I want you to think about what's your earliest memory, your earliest positive memory. Maybe it was when you were a child, maybe even as a young teenager, it depends how good your memory is. But just think about, what was your earliest positive memory? Now, I've asked this question to thousands of people now all around the world. And the second question I ask is a bit more interesting. Is I ask them, when was the last time you talked to somebody about that memory? There's normally at least one person in the room who says, well, it's been over 30 years since I even thought about that memory or spoke to somebody about it. And then I ask them this question, so where has that memory been? And what they always do is they point to the back of their head. And what they're indicating is, well, it's been in this place, which we would call the subconscious mind. It's been sitting there. And then what I say to him is, well, isn't it interesting that you could have this thought sitting in your subconscious mind, and how long did it take you to actually remember that earliest memory? And they normally say about 30 seconds. So this is the question, is could there be things going on in the back of our subconscious mind for over 30 years that's interacting with our conscious thinking all the time? And if we could have some sort of handle on this subconscious mind, could it change our levels of happiness? So, when have you most felt alive, is my next question. When have you most felt alive? There's a fantastic book called The Chimp Paradox. And The Chimp Paradox, to give it a very, very basic summary, it suggests that there are kind of two parts of the mind. There's the chimp and there's the human. And the chimp's main role is to keep us safe. Now, when I've asked this question again to thousands of people all over the world, the majority of people, when they say, this is when I most felt alive, interestingly, there was a risk involved. But the chimp, its job is to keep us safe. And particularly our parents and those who love us, they have a massive chimp in their mind. And what they do is they actually stop us from taking risks. So perhaps if feeling alive is linked to you feeling happy, perhaps there's an element of considering whether or not it's worth taking that risk every now and again. The research tells us that interdependence leads to higher levels of happiness. You see, the other thing about that question, when have you most felt alive, for nearly everybody, there was somebody else involved. That actually when we most feel alive, when we most feel happy, there's this sense of connectedness. In fact, the longest study that Harvard University have done, it's over 75 years, it's one of the longest longitudinal studies, is a study of human development. They've studied hundreds of people over 75 years, and they've done all sorts of studies with these people. And what's interesting is there's all sorts of suggestions about some findings which may be true, but there's only one finding which is absolutely certain over all those studies, and that's this, is your connectedness has a major impact on your levels of happiness and your levels of health. So I would suggest that as part of our experiment, that what you might want to do this week is to see how many times you can have a real and positive connection in the next 7 days. And when you're having that real and positive connection, is to consider whether or not you can feel a greater sense of happiness than rather than being alone. The next piece of research, which again is pretty clear now, is that meditation leads for most people to higher levels of happiness. The reason I became interested in meditation is because some of the most successful people on the planet, some of the wealthiest people on the planet, Ray Dalio, he's a hedge fund manager, Oprah Winfrey, they make a clear connection between their levels of success and meditation. So I would like to encourage you to see if actually maybe, if I practice meditation, maybe in the morning as I wake up, it gives me something I'm looking forward to, and perhaps it has an impact on your levels of happiness. So perhaps if we have got this subconscious mind that is interacting when we don't realize it with our conscious thinking all the time, and we've got these thoughts going on in the back of our heads, perhaps meditation could be a way of actually taking control of that chimp. And perhaps by using mantra meditation, we can start to reprogram our mind to think how we want to think rather than our emotions taking over. So the research tells us that optimism and humor are, again, clear activities that for most people lead to higher levels of happiness. So how are you going to do that in the experiment this week? Well, what I want to suggest you do is when things don't work out, and often they don't, is to just ask yourself this one question. What's the benefit? What's the benefit? Sometimes it's hard to work it out, and there isn't a benefit in every negative thing that happens. But by asking what's the benefit, often those small things that would have wound us up, those small things which would have often brought our levels of happiness down, all of a sudden we start to actually be able to manage that in a very positive way. The second thing is humor. And I'm particularly interested in this question of actually, can you teach yourself to be happy? So I went in London to the comedy school to learn how to be funny. Now, some of you are probably thinking you should have gone for longer, and that's true. But what I'd like to suggest is that actually you can teach yourself to have a sense of humor. And this is how comedians do it. They literally carry a notebook around with them, and they start to see the funny side in situations, the kind of the unusual side in situations. So for your experiment this week, I'd encourage you to do that, is to start to listen into people's conversations. Start to see funny things on signs. Start to see the humorous side of life. And maybe watch some comedy on Netflix or something. So one more question that I'd like one person to give us an answer to, and that's, what's your definition of forgiveness? So I wonder if someone could put their hand up. Just, there's no right or wrong answer. I just would like one person just share your definition of forgiveness. Could we have one brave person? There's no wrong answer. Just what would you say is, if you had to define forgiveness, what would it be? Who?
Probably just say an acceptance, really.
An acceptance. An acceptance of who or what?
Behavior or my behavior and how it impinged on someone. Forgiveness is a big word.
Fantastic. Now, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. You see, most people, when you ask them for their definition of forgiveness, they're often talking about forgiving others. They're often thinking, oh, forgiveness is all about, can I forgive my mum, my dad, my friend, my work colleague? Whereas actually what the research tells us is happiness is actually strongly based on your ability to forgive yourself. That if you want to have high levels of happiness, what I'd encourage you to do this week for your experiment is to write a letter to yourself. Now, if you're anything like me, it might be a very long letter because I've got lots of things that I've done wrong in my life. But I encourage you to just write a letter and just let it out and just to forgive yourself. And then perhaps to burn it or cut it up into small pieces. You don't want anybody reading it. But see how that helps and see if that increases your levels of happiness. Finally, self-efficacy. The best way to kind of think about that is to ask this question, is if you knew you couldn't fail, what would you do? And that's a question you might want to consider this week in your experiment. If you knew you couldn't fail, what would you do? You see, what the research tells us is if we have a sense of, I am in control, I can create the destiny that I want, it creates a huge level of happiness within us. So one of the best ways to kind of think about this is the kind of rise in interest in entrepreneurship. Because I think there is a coming of age of humans. I think lots of humans, we had this in therapy, we have this thing called parent-adult-child. It's a concept, parent-adult-child. And it's when we're talking to people, we're trying to understand how do people relate to each other. So in relationships, you could have one partner who acts as a parent and the other partner acts as a child. But actually, we can use the same model to think about how do we relate to our careers, our purpose. And if we ask this question of, well, do I act like a parent or an adult or a child in the workplace? For most people, the answer is a child. Just consider this. Is who makes the decisions about when you start work, when you have lunch, what your values are, how you act, what you do? Who looks after your health and safety? For most people, somebody else is doing that, and you're taking the position of the child. And when I say there's a rise in humanity, what I mean is most people are unhappy with that. In fact, the Guardian newspaper did a piece of research and it found that 1 in 3 people are unhappy at work. That's a huge amount of people. So I think one of the reasons people are unhappy at work is because they're being placed in the position of a child and I think they want to take the position of an adult or a parent. And that's making the transition from employee to entrepreneur. So the final question, which was a question that Edward Lorenz asked in 1972. He was a meteorologist. And he would put thousands of numbers into a spreadsheet, and he'd work out basically what the future forecast was going to be. You know, numbers represented time and speed and heat. And he put all these numbers in, and he gave a speech, and the speech title was, "Does the flap of a butterfly wings in Brazil set off a tornado in Texas?" You see, what he found from his research was simply this, that just taking away one number, and it wasn't even a whole number, it completely changed the future forecast of the weather. And what I want to suggest is this, that perhaps some of these activities that I've suggested you might want to experiment with this week will give you butterflies. They'll give you small changes that will completely change the future forecast of your levels of happiness. Thank you.
Mark Alfred, psychotherapist and founding director of the Institute for Leadership. On RN, you're with Big Ideas, and in this discussion, we're focusing on the ethics of happiness. Your next speaker is senior lecturer in writing at the University of Notre Dame, Camelia Nelson. Her most recent book is a co-edited collection of essays on happiness, New Ideas for the 21st Century.
So I'm here to talk about mothers, and in a sense I'm going to say something perhaps quite different to Mark's approach and even to Brock's approach, because as a humanities scholar I'm interested in culture, and I deal with what the culture tells us we should think, how we represent things to ourselves, how we put things into words, rather than what goes on inside your head. About 10 years ago, a Nobel laureate named Daniel Kahneman published a study that purported to show that American mothers ranked child care among the least pleasurable activities of their lives. This was an incidental finding, but it was swiftly replicated in studies across the American Midwest, studies in the UK, studies of relationships, of marital satisfaction. One only 2 years ago, which was billed in the UK by the Open University as being the biggest study of relationships ever undertaken in Britain. Across the English-speaking world in these studies, mothers consistently stated that childcare was less pleasurable than going to work. It was less pleasurable than commuting on a bus. And looking after your child was down there with cleaning the kitchen cupboard, washing the floor, and doing the laundry. Now, I'm a mother, and I don't want to undervalue cupboard cleaning. I get a lot of satisfaction out of cleaning the kitchen cupboards. But when I look at this welter of statistical findings as a humanities scholar, what I ask is, what did all of these psychologists, with their graphs and their charts and their statistical findings and their clean data and their data visualization software, think they were measuring? What was this thing in these studies that they called happiness? Happiness, we think we know what happiness is. You think you know what happiness is when you feel happiness. But what is it that you're feeling? What is the thing that's being named? Because I want to suggest that happiness is actually very culturally specific, is very historically specific. If you go back to the Middle Ages, the word happiness, you'll find the root word hap, is the same root word that you find in words like haphazard or mishap or indeed perhaps. Because back before they put happiness in the American Declaration of Independence, happiness actually meant good luck or good fortune. Mayhap you were happy, perhaps. Okay. Happiness today is something that is altogether different. Happiness today is individualistic. Happiness today is consumer-oriented. Happiness is about life coaching. It's about productivity boosting in corporations. It's a very, very different creature. So what worries me when I look at the welter of motherhood studies is, has happiness in our culture become such a thinned out idea, such an individualistic idea, that it can no longer accommodate basic human realities like being a parent or having a baby? Happiness is culturally constructed for scholars like me. And the cultural construction of motherhood, of happiness in mothers, the stereotype of the happy mother, of maternal bliss, of the happy housewife, or conversely, the angry feminist or the bitter spinster, is very deeply and culturally problematic. I think that despite three successive waves of feminism, we haven't quite got to grips with the mismatch between this idea of good mothers as happy mothers and the realities of human existence, the realities of being a mother, having a family, or looking after a child. Even if you consciously reject the ideas that we find in the culture, they're always there, these images of what a mother, not just what a mother ought to be, but what you ought to feel, are always there from when you wake up in the morning until you go to bed at night. It's on the television, it's on the internet, it's in the radio, you read about it in the newspapers. I think that our culture loves nothing better than to dish out the advice about how to be a happy mother, or a better mother, or a more fashionable mother, or a thinner mother. It's not just that when you turn on the TV, there's a welter of advertising, advertisements that feature women who are somehow obsessed with Alpine Fresh Cleaner. It's not just that mothers on television continue to be far better looking than any mother in reality. It's nice to see in television soap operas that there are more working mothers in television drama. But working mothers always get punished in the plot lines. Working mothers have wimpy husbands, working mothers have dysfunctional children, and bad characters have bad mothers. Serial killers in cop shows have dysfunctional mothers or alcoholic mothers or very, very deeply unhappy mothers. A good mother, our culture tells us, is a happy mother. A sad mother is a failed mother. And what does this do? What does this do to women? Strangely, I think, in a world in which the demands of the workplace have increased, so too have the ideals to which mothers aspire become more demanding, not less demanding. In recent years, I think commonly accepted ideas about what constitutes barely adequate mothering have come to entail huge sacrifices of time, of relationships, of personal hygiene, and indeed of sleep. Studies undertaken by sociologists in Australia have shown that working mothers, who make up in Australia the majority of mothers actually work, working mothers now today spend more time with their children than more non-working mothers commonly did in 1975. And how do they do that? They don't sleep, they don't eat, they sacrifice pretty much every aspect of their life, okay, to spend more time, okay, with their children. And what does it do to families? Whether you call it intensive mothering or helicopter parenting, I think that the new credos of motherhood are wholly taken up with the idea that there's a very narrowly prescribed way of doing things. Motherhood is increasingly time-consuming, expert-guided, emotionally all-absorbing, and above all else, incredibly expensive. In historical terms, I would hazard a guess perhaps that never before has motherhood been so extensively scrutinised. Because it's not just about not eating soft cheese or prawns or, God forbid, junk food when you're pregnant, okay? It's about how you ought to feel, okay, about doing that. Never before has there been such a microscopic interrogation of what a mother ought to feel. And you can see that when you read the agony columns. You can see that in popular psychology, pop psychology, the number of psychological syndromes that mothers are said to suffer from have so drastically expanded. The old list of mental disorders expanding beyond prenatal anxiety, postnatal depression, postpartum psychosis, and the baby blues to include prenatal and postnatal stress disorder, maternal anxiety and mood imbalance, and my absolute favourite, tocophobia, the latter being coined at the beginning of this millennium to describe an unreasonable fear of giving birth. And given what is represented to us, why wouldn't you be scared? Again, I want to say, the message in all of this is quite clear. A good mother is a happy mother, and a sad mother is a bad mother. Okay? The culture tells us that not just is an unhappy mother a bad mother, but an unhappy mother is, in all possibility, certifiably insane. I think that the problem that I'm trying to get at, okay, is not just about the disparity between media images and popular culture images and lived experience, okay, but going back to this idea of what is happiness. Because I think that the thing we call happiness has grown incredibly impoverished. Happiness, as it's enshrined in popular culture, is made up of continuous moments of pleasure and the absence of pain. These popular assumptions about happiness are actually of comparatively recent origin, emerging in works of philosophers like Jeremy Bentham, who argued back in the 18th century that people act purely in their self-interest and the goal to which self-interest aspires is happiness. Ethical conduct, according to Bentham and James Mill, the father of John Stuart Mill, should therefore aspire to maximise pleasure and minimise pain. This ready equation of goodness, pleasure, and happiness flew in the face of ideas that had been of concern to philosophers since Aristotle argued that a person is not made happy by fleeting pleasures, but by fulfillment stemming from meaning and purpose. Nevertheless, I think that Western assumptions about happiness have remained broadly utilitarian. And this is translated into commercials on television that show families becoming happier with every single purchase. Or life coaches telling us that we can overcome anything, whatever our personal, economic, and social circumstance. I think this idea about happiness isn't working. Before I came here tonight, I googled up the work of the blog page of a very well-known life coach. And about halfway down the page, I saw the words, quite an anathema to me as an academic, and it said, "Do not criticise. Not only will criticism diminish your happiness, it will reduce the happiness of people around you." I'm an academic. I get paid to criticise for a living. I do have a vested interest in criticism, I confess. But I immediately wanted to leave you with the flip side of the kinds of talk I've previously given about motherhood and mothering. I want to talk about something different. I want to talk about Wednesday morning down the road at the Downing Centre. Wednesday morning is AVO Day, Apprehended Domestic Violence Orders. On Wednesday mornings at the Downing Centre, about 80 AVOs will be heard in a matter of mere hours. There will be women there from every walk of life. They're not women from Struggle Street. There are rich women and affluent women and professional women. There are women from any kind of ethnic background. There are mothers with their newborn babies, and there are children. There are children who testify in associated matters. And because domestic violence is not an income-specific problem, many of those children have been set down for cross-examination by very expensive barristers who are already gathering on the Wednesday morning at the Downing Centre. If happiness is, it tells us something, if happiness is meant to say we should not criticise, we should not criticise a society that allows something like that, then maybe that's not the kind of happiness that we want. Thanks.
Camelia Nelson, Senior Lecturer in Writing at the University of Notre Dame. On RN, you're with Big Ideas, and in this edition, we're exploring the ethics of happiness. Your third and final speaker is Brock Bastian, a social psychologist at the University of Melbourne.
So I want to tell you tonight three things about happiness you might not have known. The first of these is don't try to be happy. The second of these is don't expect others to be happy. And the third is seek out more unhappiness. Any questions? I'll explain. So the first is based on some work by Jonathan Schuller, who suggested in 2003 that the pursuit of happiness may be self-defeating. Now, why would that be? To understand that, we have to think about the psychology of goal pursuit. Imagine you want a car. Maybe not this car, maybe a nicer car, but imagine that your goal in life is to own a car. Now, you're working towards your goal, and of course, goals we don't achieve immediately. We achieve them along the way. It takes time to get to goals. We stop at some point and we think, am I at my goal yet? And so you look at your bank account and you think, damn it, I haven't got enough money for my car. I really want that car today. And you feel disappointed. Now, of course, that feeling of disappointment feeds back into your attempts to get your car. You work harder, you save more, and you get your car, and you're happy. Now, imagine your goal is to be happy. You're working towards your goal to be happy. You want to be like maybe a 9 out of 10, 9 will do, and you realise, actually, I'm only a 6. I'm only a 6 out of 10, and I wish I was a 9 out of 10, and now you feel disappointed. Now, the problem is that disappointment is inconsistent with happiness, and so it feeds back into your attempts to be happy, and it interrupts them. And now you're less happy than you were when you started out. I would also like to suggest that we shouldn't expect others to be happy either. If you stop and think for a moment, happiness has really become a commodity in many ways. You can go into any bookstore and you can read a book on the happiness diet, Happiness Now, The Happiness Project, Get Happy Today, 100 Ways to Happiness, Happiness, Happiness. It's everywhere. People are spending a lot of money and people are making a lot of money off happiness. Now, of course, this hasn't been lost on advertisers. They worked out that happiness is a commodity. This is a valuable commodity. And so if they pair their products with a valuable commodity, we all want to buy those products. You don't see somebody in a car that you want to buy looking sad. They look happy. And so you think, I want that car because I want to look happy as well. But it's fair to say that we are surrounded by happiness. Everywhere on our TVs, internet, billboards, wherever it is, people looking happy all the time. And so it's sending a message to us that everyone else seems to be happy all of the time. We even started measuring the happiness of countries. And we're not only ranking countries on their GDP now, we're ranking countries on their gross domestic happiness. So now my unhappiness is not only making me sad, it's also bringing down the rank of my entire country. How bad's that? So it seems to lead to this sense of mandatory optimism, this idea that we should be happy all of the time, that it's important, it's necessary, it's valuable to be happy. On the flip side, of course, sadness is seen very differently. It's pathologized, it's medicalized. We take medication, drugs, to try and get rid of it so we can get back to the norm of being happy again, where we should be. But of course, this is completely crazy because this is the emotion circumplex. This is how we evolve. This is our emotional range of states that we can experience. And of course, there are lots on the pleasant side, lots of pleasant emotions. There are lots of unpleasant emotions as well. Now, I would venture to say that if you couldn't feel fear, you probably wouldn't be here today because you walked in front of a bus on the way here or something else very dangerous. Fear is very important. We need to feel fear. Imagine going to your grandmother's funeral and not being able to feel sad, just happy. It's important. It's important to have these negative emotions. They evolve for a reason. So what's crazy is we seem to have overlaid on this notion of success and failure. So on the right, when we're feeling all these pleasant emotions, we feel like we're successful. And when we naturally, inevitably feel the other emotions on the other side of the spectrum, we feel like we're failing. But of course, this has got nothing to do with the reason these emotions evolved. They evolve for good reason, and we just simply have overlaid this sort of interpretation on top of them. So myself and my colleagues have been sort of wondering about or thinking about how does this affect people. And we've come up with the term social expectancies. So this is the idea that we walk around and we feel that our culture, the others around us, our societies, expect us to be happy and, most importantly, not to be sad. So the problem is not when people want us to be happy. That's a good thing. It's when people want us to be always happy, necessarily happy, and that then means that sadness becomes a problem. And so we ask people, it's important that others don't see me as an anxious or a depressed person. Other people expect me not to feel anxious or depressed. And society generally expects people not to feel anxious or depressed. So again, these are sort of this perception of the culture, the society that I live in, the others around me. We also ask people whether they feel, you know, whether feeling depressed or anxious makes them dislike themselves. And when they feel depressed or anxious, they feel like a bad person. And we found that to the extent that people do sort of hold this notion of social expectancies, they believe that others expect them not to have these negative emotional states, which we inevitably all do. This makes them feel bad about themselves when they do have these emotional states. And this leads to an increased intensity of negative emotion, an increased frequency of negative emotion, a reduced satisfaction with life, and an increased level of depression. So it would suggest that living in a happiness culture where we believe that it's important to always be happy may actually be making us sad. It may actually be breeding depression. And of course, if 1 in 5 people are depressed, we have to start thinking about this as an epidemic, not just an individual problem. This has become an epidemic. What are the cultural factors that are starting to feed into a 1 in 5 kind of figure of depression and anxiety and other sorts of difficulties that people deal with on a yearly basis? We also wonder whether, you know, feeling sad in a culture where you believe that it's important to be happy might make you feel more lonely. We gave 200 Belgian students smartphones. They beeped 10 times a day for 7 days. And they, at each beep, they said how angry, sad, stressed, anxious, depressed, and lonely they felt at that moment. We also gave them our social expectancies questionnaire at the beginning. What we found was that people who held high social expectancies, believe they lived in cultures where they were expected to be happy all the time, when they did feel negative emotional states, they felt more lonely, disconnected from people around them. And of course, being connected to others, as Mark has mentioned, is very, very important to our well-being. And so if we're feeling negative emotions and feeling disconnected, This suggests some sort of negative downward spiral is going to take place. So I suggested to you that we shouldn't try to be happy. We shouldn't expect others to be happy. So what's the answer? Well, clearly, we should seek out more unhappiness. You're probably thinking, well, Brock, I don't want to feel like that all the time and, you know, sad and in pain. Why would I want to feel like that? I want to feel like this. That's what I want to feel like. I want to feel happy and joyful and happy and joyful. I want to be in fields of wheat and just full of joy, constantly, always joyful, just always joyful. And then suddenly the more that I say it, the more you think, hang on a sec, no, I'm not sure that's actually what I want to always, you know. This is what Aldous Huxley thought about when he wrote A Brave New World. He wrote about a world in which we could eradicate our negative emotions and we could always feel happy. Now, he wasn't writing about a utopia. He was writing about a dystopia. It scared him. This idea scared him. And that's why we start to back away from it. And, of course, this is because of the way pleasure works. You can imagine walking into a chocolate shop full of fat and sugar, two of the most rewarding substances to humans. And you walk in there and you just think, wow, this is just full of pleasure. And you just start indulging yourself in pleasure, and you eat chocolate, and you eat chocolate, until you end up like this. We can't have endless pleasure. It's impossible. If you think about your happiest moment in life, people normally say having a baby, graduating from college, or getting married. Now, if you break these experiences down and look at what they're comprised of, they're comprised of pain, failure, and loss. Giving birth occurs in the context of great pain. I've seen it with my own eyes. It wouldn't be so grand to achieve a degree and pass if it wasn't that you avoided the possibility of dismal failure. If it was guaranteed no one's going to pat you on the back, no one's going to give you a certificate, right? It's only because you could have failed that it's such a fantastic experience that you graduated. And of course, love opens you to the threat of loss. And that's what makes love so powerful. Of course, Panadol doesn't quite agree with this. Panadol sees it quite differently. They say when pain is gone, life takes its place. We get rid of pain and then we start living. But we disagree. We've been working a lot on the positive consequences of pain and understanding the various ways that pain may actually be leading to us living happy and fulfilling lives. And one of those ways is that pain can actually bring us together. If you look at the painting here of a wartime, you know, soldiers are sort of thrown together. They've forged very, very strong bonds in war, but you don't have to look that far. You can look to, say, a Tough Mudder event, Weekend Warrior type stuff, you know, getting muddy, jumping in. Everyone knows about Tough Mudder events, you know. These are sort of pretty painful. They, you know, electrodes, big, you know, ice buckets. These guys, they do it in groups. They're getting something from it. It's a social activity. In the Northern Hemisphere, people jump into icy cold water on New Year's Day. Again, it's a social activity. It's good for a hangover too, probably. But it's also a social activity. What are people getting from these experiences? I was in Brisbane when the floods hit, the whole city was basically flooded. Now, what was incredibly amazing was on that weekend, 55,000 people turned up to help. The biggest problem was not cleaning up. The biggest problem was managing the people who came to clean up. We didn't know what to do. I went down to try and help, and I got sandwiches and a drink. That was about as far as I got. There was nothing to do. It was incredible. In New York, when September 11 occurred, volunteering across the country spiked massively, and not just for activities related to the crisis, for a range of activities, including activities focusing on unpopular targets, things that people often sort of deride, or groups that are often the result of prejudice. People started volunteering their time, just generally. So we wanted to bring this into the lab and see, well, you know, could just simple basic experiences of pain lead people to actually feel bonded together, to cooperate more? So we got people into the lab and we got them to put their hands in ice buckets, you know, buckets of ice water for as long as they could in groups. We got them to do leg squats for as long as they could, again in groups. Then we gave them this task. So it's a game. So you can choose a number between 1 and 7. There's 6 different trials. If you choose a 7, you can get $7.80. If everyone else chooses a 7, you can. Unless somebody chooses a 1, one person chooses a 1, then everyone who chose a 7 now only gets 60 cents. But that person who chose a 1 gets $4.20. So if you want to guarantee yourself $4.20, you choose a 1. But if you want to cooperate and work together and trust other people towards benefiting the group and getting more money together, then you all choose a 7. People who shared a painful experience versus people who did a very similar activity, We had them put their hands into buckets of warm water and balance on one leg instead of doing leg squats. People who just shared pain chose higher numbers. They were more willing to cooperate together as a group. Now, we wanted to bring this into the real world a little more because it's pretty unusual that you kind of, you know, hang out putting your hands in buckets of ice and doing leg squats together. Not everybody. But what we do is we eat chili. We eat hot chilies. We go out and enjoy a hot curry together. And could simply eating hot chili lead to an increase in cooperation? We'd run the same experiment again, but this time we gave people hot chili. Half the people got hot chili, half the people got butterscotch lollies. It's a fairly pleasant experience. We then played the same game again, even stronger. People who ate chili cooperated more together on the task, chose higher numbers, trusted each other more than people who ate the butterscotch lolly. So there's three points that I want you to walk away with. Don't try to be happy. Don't expect others to be happy. And seek out more unhappiness. And if you do, I promise you will be exactly like this. Thank you.
Brock Bastian, social psychologist at the University of Melbourne and an ARC Future Fellow in the School of Psychology. And now on Big Ideas, let's hear what the audience has to say on the ethics of happiness.
How do you teach your children to be happy?
I don't think you can teach children to be happy. I don't think you can teach people to be happy. I think that once you have an insistence that your child be happy, it's usually counterproductive. But the other thing about your schemes as a mother, your schemes for happiness for your children, is that they tend to be quite coercive. When you say, "I just want you to be happy," to your child, you tend to mean, well, I want you to get straight A's on your school report. You know, I want you to get a student award. I want you to be the captain of the school. You know, you've got this whole plan of action laid out in your head for your child. And that plan is not going to bring your child happiness necessarily. In fact, it will probably have the absolute opposite result. Yeah, that is not something that... I'm not a psychologist, so I'll pass this along to Brock next. Yes, certainly, I think that there are kind of coercive aspects to this idea that I just want you to be happy.
I think you can in some ways. And so, I mean, I think one of the key things is that you first teach them that it's okay if you're not. And that's the most important key to being happy, right? And so almost as Mark did with the mindfulness type exercise, I mean, mindfulness puts you in a place of non-evaluation. That's the point of mindfulness. Is you're now not placing evaluative labels on things that are coming in from your external world. And so what that allows you to do is engage with your experiences directly rather than evaluating them as good and bad, good and bad. And I suppose it's the same thing with when you have experiences which are unpleasant, rather than seeing those things as bad and I don't want to have them and struggling with them, which tends to be, you know, dysfunctional. It tends not to lead to... It's not a good emotion regulation strategy. So accepting and being okay and comfortable with these negative experiences in life and allowing them to be the case, allowing yourself to have a down day, a blue day, allowing your kids to feel upset, to express their negative emotions, and that it's okay if they're not happy... Then that actually is, again, probably one of the key ways to actually allowing, you know, teaching kids to be happy, I would say.
So I'm not a parent, but I was an assistant principal and I've worked in schools for 17 years. So this is my question, actually, because that's what I'm doing my PhD on. So I'm glad somebody's asking it. So my PhD is actually on how can we teach our children to be happy through education, because... I again believe it is possible. Those things that I shared today, that's what I would be experimenting with children. For example, how can we help you to be more connected and not disconnected? Because I think, not to be sound old, like, you know, you shouldn't be on Facebook and everything else, but I do think that I think I'm very glad that I was born in an era where the internet didn't exist, that I was somebody who actually connected with real life human beings, and I think that had a massive impact on my levels of happiness, and also that people encouraged me to take risks, and I think that had a big impact on my levels of happiness. So there's two insights, but I'm only the first year into my PhD, so I'll come back to you.
I think if I can add to that, that the risk taking I think is really, really important. And it's funny because more and more and more, if I think about the way that I lived when I was young, and then if I was to let my kids live like that, do the things, and then the sort of the kind of vitriol I'd probably get from other people around me, you know, why are you being such a terrible parent and not sort of protecting your children all the time from risk? And that worries me a little bit, because I think there's very, very good evidence to suggest that letting kids take risks, to have bumps and bruises, to experience these things actually breeds resilience. And that's a really important way to be happy as well. And so we are kind of wrapping our kids in cotton wool, and I think that is increasingly leading to an entitlement culture too. So I think that's a risk is really critical.
My name's Ingrid. I don't want to take away from the chat or anything, but do you think sometimes we're sort of overthinking a normal human emotion? Like, yeah. You know, it was a fantastic talk, but I sort of think, isn't happiness just like sadness, or, you know, feeling a little bit insecure or unsure of yourself or embarrassed? Or, because to me, you can't have happiness if you don't have sort of pain or sadness or any of the other human emotions. I mean, it's a bit like the Friday afternoon feeling you get if you've worked. You'd never have that feeling if you never worked. So it's kind of quite simple, I think.
Are we overcomplicating a simple human emotion?
Yeah.
I think no. Quite frankly, I think no, because if we were now sitting in some sort of refugee camp, we wouldn't be having this debate. What we'd be thinking about is food and water and clean sanitation. And now that would be what our most important thing in life would be, and we wouldn't be overthinking happiness. Now, as you go up Maslow's hierarchy of needs and you satisfy those basic needs, we get up to these higher order ones, and that's where we all are now. Now, is that a lesser problem? Should we just ignore it because we have all our basic needs met? No, because actually in our worlds is a real thing. It's a real thing and it really matters. We're lucky enough that it can matter, but it does matter. And so, you know, you also find that the more money people have, the higher up that order of needs they end up as well. And so they end up struggling with other sort of higher order sorts of things than if they were stuck in poverty. So, of course, it's all relative, yeah.
And they'll have sad times and they'll have, you know, so...
They'll just reflect on them less.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
I think you're sort of talking about happiness as a sort of discrete emotional experience, and I think the way that it's being talked about more is really this sort of, you know, the opposite to sadness, and this is kind of the whole emotional valence that we experience. So when we talk about happiness, we're talking about all those positive emotions, I think. But you're right, I mean, we can also think about it as one discrete emotion too, and of course that'd be overthinking that one emotion. But I think broadly we're thinking about, you know, pleasantness, pleasant emotion experiences on that pleasant side of the spectrum, if you like.
I get frustrated by how many books are sold on happiness. That doesn't seem right to me.
Yeah. Sure, on them fear
they're
or sadness.
Cashing in.
Yeah.
Guys, we have to wrap up. Mark, Brock, Camilla, thank you so much for your time this evening.
You've been listening to Highlights of the Ethics of Happiness, presented by the Ethics Centre in Sydney. Our thanks to the panel, Brock Bastian, social psychologist at the University of Melbourne, Camilla Nelson, senior lecturer in writing at the University of Notre Dame, and Mark Alford, psychotherapist and founding director of the Institute for Leadership. And that's the program. Thanks for your company. I'm Paul Barclay. Until next time, bye for now.